Food Talk with Mike Colameco has been brought to you by Cento, Calavita, and Wines of Portugal.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome, Mike Colameco here. Food Talk live again this week. It feels like fall outside today. It's that time of year when the temperature just keeps changing. It was like tank top weather 2 days ago, and now I'm on my bicycle and I'm cold. Shout out to a couple of things that happened this week. Just some good friends. My friend Master Sam Pascaline Lepeltier led a great tasting of Savanier wines, that wonderful Loire Valley white, on Monday night at Racine, a great little wine bar in Tribeca. I'll talk more about that wine when I have more time, but I don't today. Great wine. I've talked about it before on the show. Love the Loire Valley wines in general. And I want to shout out to my chef friend, Bill Rogers at Keen's. We were there last night. I don't go to Keen's much. It is amazing. It's my favorite steakhouse in the country. I had that mutton chop and his insane dry-aged meat. You know what? Every time I'm there, which is only once, twice a year, I'm like, God, I could do this all the time, but I'd weigh 300 pounds. But anyway, thanks to those guys. Let's just go with the show. We've got three guests today. Here's what it's going to look like if everybody shows up. You never can tell here. My first guest is in studio with me now, Noreen Allison Cohen.
I'm Allison Cohen.
Allison Cohen. So yeah. Noreen was Allison Cohen. Sorry about that. So you're from Brooklyn.
I am.
A rough title is?
I am the
Food Justice
Advocate. Yes, so I'm the Senior Director of Programs for Why Hunger.
Tell us about Why Hunger, when it got started.
Sure. So Why Hunger got started in 1975, and it was the collaborative sort of brainchild of Harry Chapin from Long Island and our current executive director, Bill Ayers. And they were on a radio show together. Bill is a radio guy also, and he was doing a, at the time, a Catholic priest doing a radio, like a rock and roll show, and had Harry Chapin on the show. And they started talking about hunger. And from there, they said, we're going to do a concert. It's going to be a big concert. We're going to make a difference in the hunger crisis in Ethiopia and the famine crisis in Ethiopia.
And 1975.
Yeah.
That was pretty prescient. I mean, that's
yes,
a long time
yes,
ago.
Yeah. And they realized, though, got that underway, and they realized, you know what? We got to be in this forever. We got to be in this until we end hunger. And then, unfortunately, Harry died very tragically in the early 80s. And Bill took up the mantle and decided to really form the organization and keep it going.
National?
We are international. We work predominantly in the United States. I would say about 80-90% of our programming is actually here in the United States. So we work a lot on domestic hunger, but we're also supporting social movements around the world that are also striving to end hunger in their own countries.
How do you survive with the financial end of it? Donations?
Yes. We're actually getting ready to enter our annual Hungerthon period. So on radio shows, Sirius XM and Clear Channel and various radio shows in the tri-state area, CBS, around the week of Thanksgiving, you'll hear a lot about us. And so we do a huge annual fundraising drive called Hungerthon during that time. And you can also read about it and check it out on hungerthon.org.
You're in this area. I know your view is broader than this, but let's talk about the New York metro area and even the suburbs, because it's hard to put a face on hunger. It's this invisible thing.
I think such an important point that it's an invisible thing.
It is. And in this food obsessed culture where people like me, like a bad day is not having a good tasting menu the night before
yeah.
or something pathetic, you know, the wine didn't match the proteins.
Right.
There's a lot of people.
Meanwhile,
right
yes.
around the corner from us. When I live on the Lower East Side, yeah. I've got 140,000 units of public housing to the north, south, and east yeah. of me. Older Chinese population.
2.6 million people in the New York City area.
2.6 million,
one in five children
right.
that have trouble. It's not, you know, hunger is different these days. Like you said, it's very invisible. So in many cases, it's not severe malnutrition. It's not necessarily associated with indigence that you can see, right? But we're talking about working families. We're talking about people that single-headed households, women-headed households, where mothers working two jobs, and still, and perhaps even on food stamps, what we call SNAP now, and not able to make ends meet. And so, over the last 50 years, since the sort of advent of the food banking system, food banking has done nothing to end hunger. It's been fantastic, such a great band-aid to help people who need food now. But it has not, our response to hunger in this country has not really moved us closer to ending it.
Which is crazy. And I know that this last recession just exacerbated it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
absolutely.
The stock market and all that happened in 08 and 09 just sort of gutted a lot of jobs, a lot of careers in New York City, threw people who were barely getting by back down to the point where they weren't getting by. I mean, a great interface might be the New York City public school system. Feeds a million kids a day.
Absolutely.
And for a lot of the, I mean, I know Jorge Collazo, the chef.
Yes, me
great,
too.
Great guy.
Yes.
Great guy. You know, I don't know what the percentages are, but a good percentage of those kids that are coming in for the breakfast program, they might not have had dinner last night.
Right. And breakfast and lunch at school might be their only meals. And then you've got the weekends coming up. So that's a, you know, that's it, it's a big issue. There is an after school program now that not, I don't know how many schools in New York are, have embraced it, where you can get a meal as well in the afternoon. But it's a perfect opportunity to, and I think school food has gone a long way towards really helping us get to a point where we don't have malnutrition and that level of hunger in this country, but yet we haven't tackled the food insecurity issue. And for us at Why Hunger, we believe and we know very firmly that that is because people are poor. People are hungry because they don't have enough money to buy food.
It's, we're having this ridiculous debate nationally, well, state to state, because that's how the laws are carved out, about minimum wage.
Right.
And, you know, you and I, again, I mean, luckily I was a chef most of my life and ate well because I was in a kitchen most of the day and had a career arc that was pretty good. But, I mean, you do the math and you think of women or men making whatever the minimum wage is in New York, $7 or $8 an hour. $8.50, whatever the number is. Multiply that times 40 hours a week. Take out taxes. We know what the rent structure is like. We know what a Metro card costs.
Right.
God forbid something happens like you get sick or you need a new pair of... People just can't get by on that kind of a wage.
Yeah.
These are working people that have jobs, sometimes a job and a half, and still can't feed their family for every month.
And the thing about that is that food is one of the most easily negotiable sort of expenses that we have every month, right? So childcare, you got to pay for it. Transportation, you got to get to work, you know, and those costs aren't necessarily flexible. Hunger is the one thing that a family, a working class family, a poor family can control. They can say, okay, I'm going to skip meals Monday, Wednesday, and Friday so that my kids eat, or we're going to water things down, or we're going to only eat twice. And so the government programs that exist are really critical. They're very, very critical in helping, but they're also not enough. Meanwhile, our Congress is debating cutting SNAP.
It's just, there's this disconnect that's almost irreconcilable.
Right. And if we could raise the minimum wage, if we could create a living wage, we could probably overnight end hunger in this country.
And can we touch on the elderly, too? Because that's like another face to this. I mean, we know about the kids. We know about the working families. We know about parents that are struggling and maybe they'll do without so that their kids can eat. But New York also has an aging population.
Right.
Some of that aging population is knowing. They're living on social services, government subsidies.
Fixed incomes.
Right. So when Gail Green started Meals on Wheels years ago, that idea was let's get, you know, people that are shut-ins. I mean, I live on the Lower East Side in Co-op Village, which is this great sort of changing neighborhood, but there's a lot of older people in those buildings.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Chinese population next to me that's specifically that the housing's designed for older. You could just tell. I mean, they don't get out much. They don't look great.
And the rising cost of healthcare doesn't help in that either.
So tell us some stories about what you do in New York. What are you doing? Tell us about some active programs
that
you guys
do. So our organization is a grassroots support organization. So we really believe that many of the answers, many of the sort of innovative solutions and creative ideas out there are coming from the communities that are experiencing hunger and food insecurity themselves. And so we support those leaders and those organizations to build their capacity to really amplify their voices. We also do a program called Imagine There's No Hunger, and that's our international program that is that we do in conjunction with Hard Rock International and Yoko Ono Linen. And so we do a campaign every November and December and January throughout the various Hard Rock hotels and cafes, and raise money to support grassroots organizations that are connected to social movements internationally. And we, all of those organizations, all the organizations we support are working at the root causes of hunger and poverty.
We've been talking locally, and I want to take it back to local because that's where I kind of want to keep the conversation, but you can throw out some factoids. I mean, a billion people wake up around the world wondering if they're going to have enough calories that day to feed their family?
Yes, just about a billion. The FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, has sort of dialed that back a little bit, but somewhere between 800,000 and a billion people. 800 million and a billion people,
right.
Every day, yes. And the number of folks that live on less than $2 a day is, you know, is close to that as well.
Yeah.
Here in the United States, we have approximately 49 million people that are daily faced with food insecurity of some kind or another. Again, maybe not that level of malnutrition, but what we're seeing here in this country, and this is beginning to spread around the world as well, is this hunger-obesity paradox. So talk about the invisibility of hunger. It is not so much about the sometimes the number of calories, but it's the kind of calories,
right,
and what's available, you know, and the Bronx is number one in the world for this hunger obesity paradox.
You go back a couple generations to say the work of Walker Evans, where mm-hmm. the photography mm-hmm. as he toured Appalachia, and we have in our heads the gaunt mom, the gaunt dad, rail thin, cheekbones
right.
sticking out, kids wearing rags standing behind them. That was poverty. That was the
right.
face of poverty. That's what it looked like. It meant you didn't have enough to eat. You were thin and just getting by.
Right.
And now, to your point, a community like the Bronx, underserved with shopping options, underserved
right.
with and healthy food options,
right.
overloaded with fried food and fast food
mm-hmm.
joints. And now the new face of poverty is most likely an overweight dad, an overweight mom, and overweight
Perhaps.
Kids.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
We're talking about adult onset type 2 diabetes
yes.
is
yes.
now 30%,
right.
I believe, somewhere around 30%
yeah,
in the Bronx.
Yeah, and it's astronomical, and it's one of the highest, one of the highest pockets of that very paradox that you'll see in this country. Even higher in some cases than some of the reservations, where it can get very high as well, the obesity hunger paradox. And
so we've got built. Mm-hmm. I don't want to interrupt. Sorry,
sure.
But so we've had an election, and de Blasio ran as a progressive,
right?
And one is a progressive,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not. Give the guy a chance. He hasn't been in office
right.
all that long. But is there any talk about changes? Are we nibbling around the edges?
Yes.
Is there anything going on?
We are. We are very much nibbling around the edges. And he has an amazing person who's that he's appointed to work on the food policy issues in the city, Barbara Turks. And I spoke to her recently. Actually, we were at a meeting together, and she was telling me that, you know, we're going to make significant changes. We have such an opportunity with this current administration. And it's going to be slow. The change is going to be slow. And that is deliberate and intentional so that we can do it right, codify it, and maintain it. So we'll see. I don't know exactly what those, you know, what those solutions are at this point. I know, for instance, they've just made middle school lunch universal in this city, which goes a long way towards destigmatizing the school food. So that everybody in middle school, doesn't matter what your income is, and if you're in public middle school in New York City, you can have access to lunch for free.
It wasn't available before?
No. Universal free lunch is not available in this country.
Breakfast was, but lunch
breakfast,
wasn't.
Breakfast, never lunch.
See, that's crazy. I didn't know. So you pay for lunch.
You pay for lunch unless you fall below a certain income level.
Right, you qualify.
However, you get in the lunch line as a middle school student with your card that says I'm low income next to the person who's pulling out $5 or whatever it is to $2.50 or whatever it is to pay for lunch. So the destigmatizing is a really important piece of, I think, one of the important puzzle pieces in really combating hunger in this country.
My guest is Allison Cohen, the name of the organization is Why Hunger. Is there a place people can go and donate or can find out more about you? Is there a website, shout out?
Mm-hmm. Yep, whyhunger.org.
Simple.
whyhunger.org or hungerthon.org starting next week.
Tell me about hungerthon.org. This is what's happening.
Yeah, so this is our annual fundraising and advocacy campaign. The focus is to really talk about hunger as a basic human right, and to really have an opportunity to be on public radio stations and non-public radio stations, privately owned radio stations around the country, talking about the root causes of hunger and poverty. At the same time, asking folks to consider making a donation as well.
Yeah, it's crazy. So statistics again in America,
49 million.
It's nuts.
Uh-huh. 1 in 6 children, 17% of all households.
Crazy. And it cuts its, I talked to my friends in New Jersey, friends in Connecticut. I mean, you think of Connecticut, you think of, Greenwich and Darien and then New Cane and then Biffy and Muffy and Bentley's. And yet all throughout this state, there's families and pockets of people that don't have enough food to eat, just getting by.
And, very likely there's, a kid sitting next to your kid in school that you'll have no idea. Again, we've made it invisible, and it's time to really talk about the fact that majority of people that benefit from SNAP, from food stamps in this country, are working.
Incredible. You're right. Okay. What brought you to this work? I'm just curious.
Oh,
what got you so years ago? When did the light go on? 2 years
well,
ago,
I,
8 years ago.
I grew up in rural North Carolina and in the middle of tobacco country. Oof. And so food and agriculture has always been something that's been kind of near and dear to me and that I've been concerned about. And then I started traveling and going overseas to Haiti and West Africa and a combination of, and then coming back home and realizing that, hey, we've got this issue in our own backyard. And also really believing very strongly in the power of community to make a difference, to really advocate for themselves, and a real grassroots bottom-up approach. Having grown up and being raised in a really small rural town, and also just seeing rural America dry up, that was to me very, very
The jobs just went
personally piercing. Yeah,
yeah. Whether it was there used to be furniture manufacturing,
right.
And those jobs. It's just America's just got
right.
Got
and then the big box stores coming in. So Walmart comes in, and suddenly you have no more hardware store. You have no more, mom and pop, diner because Walmart takes it over.
Is there anything on a federal level? I wouldn't want to be in President Obama's shoes with the Congress that we have
right.
and
the
mood in Washington to try and move any idea, no matter how genuinely useful it is, forward.
Right.
Is there anything they've done or can do? I know Michelle has been talking about school lunches and health and exercise.
Yes,
and,
she has, and I think that has been a move it. That whole effort has done a lot in the White House garden and Sam Cass, and they've done a lot to really elevate the issue. The prescriptions have not been there.
Correct. And across the board, the will just isn't there.
No, the political will is not there.
Yeah, and it's sad because I think there's almost this horribly twisted notion of if you're poor and if you're hungry, it's because you're not working hard enough
right.
and you deserve it.
Right.
I mean, that's honestly, I hate to say that in that way,
but
I think the American mindset is we've done okay. Those of us that are doing okay are doing okay. Those of you that aren't, it's your fault.
Right, right. And I think that given our current political climate, that kind of narrative is really starting to bubble up again. And we have to work hard. We have to work really hard to change that narrative because it's just not the truth.
Well, you're great. All right. Thanks again so much for coming in from a few miles away. That takes forever because crossing Brooklyn is not easy.
Thanks for having me.
Whyhunger.org. Allison Cohen's been my guest. Now more than ever, we need people like you and your organization doing the work you do, because it's a problem that seems to be getting worse before it's going to be getting better.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we really appreciate the opportunity to be on the show and to put out a different narrative.
Well, hopefully you'll be on Brian Lehrer or Leonard Lopate one of these days.
I'm waiting for the call.
Push those schmucks. They're good. They're good. And you've got a great story to tell.
Thank you.
Sorry,
thank you so
Mr.
much.
Lopate. I hate to be called Lenny. It's Leonard. Take care. We're going to have my next guest coming in a minute to talk about olive oil. We're going to take a quick moment, bring up some music, and we'll be right back.
All right. Thank you.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, and this is Mike Colomeco. You're listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on HeritageRadio.org. Indeed. Good show today. My next guest is Joanne Lacina, who is an expert on something that I've certainly been using in my house for years and has become ubiquitous in American kitchens. Olive oil, right? Thought that was simple. It's not so simple. So we're going to shine a little light on what's really kind of, oh, I don't want to say it, the dirty business, but I wish I could find another word for it. Where do we start this conversation? So maybe just throw out some numbers. Olive oil consumption has been going up in this country.
Absolutely.
It's become like a thanks to the, you know, cooking shows like mine and the TV Food Network and our cultural interest, and we know it's a good oil for you. So if you went back 15 or 20 years on the average supermarket shelf, you would have probably had 3 or 4 brands.
Right.
And now you've got 25 to choose from of blends.
Now it's
and
overwhelming.
It's crazy. So what is the consumption in the U.S. of olive oil?
The consumption is now the largest consumer per capita of olive oil.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
We're not there with wine yet, but we're the largest drinkers of wine on the planet.
Yeah,
we just took over France, and we drink more. And they're, as their populations drink less, we're drinking more, which is great. So we're at this moment when we're in all this good stuff. But, I mean, let's cut right to the chase. You tell me how you got interested in the olive oil business.
I had a career change about 8 years ago and just kind of got a one-way ticket to Greece. And I ended up staying there for 2 years and really just, you know, I had your basic olive oil in my kitchen growing up. And I went there and people were just using copious amounts of olive oil. I mean, pitchers of olive oil in their kitchen. You'd get a Greek salad in front of you and people would just pour about a cup of olive oil into the salad until the vegetables were swimming in it. And that was just, why are you using so much oil? and it tasted so different.
Yeah.
You know, what is this stuff? This isn't like anything I've had before. It was grassy. It had a little tingle on the tongue and in the back of the throat.
Right, it has acid to it that's present in it. So there is a thing, and you studied this. I mean, you so mm-hmm. The term extra virgin olive oil. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's just sort of get to the nasty buzzwords. There really is. There are tasters and evaluators that determine what an EVO is. Correct.
Yes, there are chemical parameters and organoleptic qualities that an oil must meet in order to be considered extra virgin.
And that some of it has to do with how quickly the olives after they're harvested are crushed, how they're crushed, how they're stored.
There's so many factors.
So many factors because there's so many things that can go wrong. And I always try and make the comparison, being a food guy and a wine guy, that olives are a fruit much mm-hmm. like grapes. And when you think of the grape harvest, if you think of going to a region during the harvest, it's so important to get the grapes picked at the perfect ripeness, to get them at selection so the bad grapes are sorted out, because mm-hmm. one or two bad grapes in a batch of gallons and gallons ruins the entire batch. To get that crushed, to watch how the, you know, how much oxygen it sees. I mean, there's so many things that happen. And then even into fermentation. And olive oil is no different.
Pretty much. Yeah, it is a fruit juice.
Yeah.
And you do have to pick the olives just at the right time. I mean, back in the day, they would just wait until the olives turned black, fell off the trees. Right. Oh, let's pick them up off the ground. Let's throw them outside in a pile outside the mill. Let them sit there for a while. You know, then maybe crush them and we'll get a whole lot of oil out of there. But that oil that was coming out was barely edible at all.
Right. So it's really, so talk about the correct way to do it so we can explain to people. I mean, because it's a fruit, it ripens at a certain time. I don't care which country you pick. It could be Italy, Greece, Spain, Tunisia, Morocco. All these places produce a good amount of great olive oil.
Yeah, yeah.
But when it's done right, how is it done?
Well, for instance, in Crete right now, they're actually going to start harvesting on Monday. This is when the olives are still green and just beginning to turn a little bit purple. That is the optimum time to pick the olives. If you pick them too early, the olive will the oil will be very bitter, very pungent. It will be off balance in flavor. So if you want to pick at this perfect time to kind of have the perfect balance. Flavored oil, and then you have to take the olives to the mill right away.
Right, I mean, like literally within 24 hours of the time they're picked.
Yeah, and every mill that I have visited of our producers, you go to the field with them, to the groves, and they're picking olives, and then the truck goes straight to the mill, and those basically get unloaded. They wait their turn in the crusher, but they basically go into the crusher within hours. And that oil that comes out is as fresh as it can be.
And in the old days, that crusher was usually two pieces of stone that rolled around on each other. These days, no one's using that. It's pretty much a centrifuge and a press.
Yeah. I mean, Italy still likes their stone crushers, but they use a centrifuge as well.
Post.
Yeah.
To separate.
Yeah. But that is the proper way to do it. Yeah, you want to avoid getting any oxygen into the process.
Yeah. Again, it's very similar to winemaking. Mm-hmm. It's going to sound like 60 minutes. All right, so European label laws, because I was in the food business I've worn a lot of hats over the years. Mm-hmm. I was in the import business, export business, dealt with labeling laws. European labeling laws are relatively strict in order to what they can call things.
Yes, the labeling laws are, yes.
Stricter. In America, to call something an extra virgin olive oil, what enforcement is there? What's to prevent me from importing a tank farm blend of whatever I want? It could be 50% olive oil, 50% something else, and I just want to call it Mike Colomeco's extra virgin olive oil. What's to stop me?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nobody's going to stop you.
Literally not. So there's no...
There's nobody policing the market here. In Europe, you're breaking the law.
Correct.
And you will be fined.
And it happened.
Time.
In Italy, guys have gone to jail for this.
Yep.
I mean, not that I don't want to talk about it. What's going on in the Italian olive oil business. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in Italy, people have been prosecuted for just this, false labeling.
Mm-hmm.
In the
mm-hmm.
United States, it's rife.
It's the Wild Wild West.
Completely.
Yeah.
So what percentage of the extra virgin olive oil, because... I mean, this is kind of fun. I mean, you know, you can go to a kind of a boutique-y, like a Fairway or a Citarella mm-hmm. or a Dean & DeLuca, and you'll find extra virgin olive oils that cost $30 a quart, mm-hmm. $26. And then you'll find 3-liter tins that are selling for $14.95.
Yeah.
How is anybody supposed to know?
Just by that.
Right.
Well, you look at the price. I mean, you know, price isn't always an indicator of quality, but if it's cheap and too cheap, it's just not extra virgin.
What percentage of the extra virgin that's being sold as extra virgin isn't?
I can't give you an accurate number because, you know, there has to be a major study and some major testing going on in the industry to do that.
None of it's done. So it's self-enforcing. We're letting the industry self-enforce.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you have to, you know, everybody's looking for the best price out there. And people name their price. They say, I want an extra virgin olive oil for $9.99 a 3-liter tin, because that's what I bought it from this guy over here.
And make it happen.
Make it happen.
So talk about this international business. Talk about, you know what, let's take a quick spot. We have to do a break at the bottom of the show. Let's do a break and we'll come back with you after this. A couple of minutes of people that make this show happen. And we'll pick up with that thread. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius. And these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece. And that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on priced. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of Ports Up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. Like, I keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we're back. This is Mike Colomeco from Mike Colomeco's Food Show, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network here. Yes, you are. We're back. So let's talk about, first of all, tell me about your business, because you have actually a company that helps people buy olive oil, oliveoillovers.com.
Yes.
Period. And what you've done is you've selected olive oils, curate, describe, all that kind of stuff. So people can go to your website and buy oil.
For 8 years, I've been building connections in the industry, making relationships with some really, really, really excellent, hardworking producers producing amazing quality olive oils. And so every oil that's on Olive Oil Lovers has been picked by myself.
And they really do. Again, to my point about olives and grapes, and not to beat this to death, but you know, throughout Italy, there's probably 400 or 500 varieties of olives, and the olives to the south in Bari are very different than the olives in Liguria. Yeah. Slope consideration matters. It's just like wine, elevation, age of the tree, what the temperature swings are like. So, I mean, olive oil, you could describe flavor profiles a million ways. Price points will be all over the place. But it's an amazing kind of way to explore this thing.
Yeah, it's really it's really an ingredient. It's not just a it's there with the cooking oils on the shelf, but it's really an ingredient with flavor. I mean, everybody, I wish everybody had four different oils in their kitchen at all times, because certain oils just pair really well with different things, and it really, really boosts, you know, boost the depth of flavor of any dish.
And they, I mean, you know, for the French and the Spanish and the Italians and the Greeks and the Portuguese that grew up with this, it's like cultural, it's a given. But come to the United States, where we talked about this off microphone, where the, you know, Italy exports 100 times more oil than Italy produces. Where's that oil? It's coming out as product of Italy, but it's coming in on boats, in tank cars, to Italian ports, being blended in tank farms. And it just blends from around the world to hit a certain price point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of Italy imports a lot of oil from Morocco, Tunisia, Spain, of course. And, you know, this is low-grade oil, you know, oil that you would not call extra virgin, that's for sure. Deodorized oil. And they make little special blends at their tank farms.
And even color them with artificial coloring to make them look greener or whatever you want.
Yeah.
Like, all that stuff happens.
Again, it's sort of that name your price. You know, I need something at this price. You know, make me a quote extra virgin for this special price. This is what I got
to
sell.
And for years, it used to drive me nuts, but I used to see it retail. I don't so much anymore, but there's an oil called pomace oil that's made from the pomace, which is the sort of the scraps after you've actually processed the olives and olive oil. You have this massive olivey mess that actually still has 10% somewhere buried in there is oil. How do they extract that oil from the pomace?
So this olive pomace has about 5% of oil still left in it. So this goes to a special olive pomace refinery, and just like as with any seed oils, how do you get that oil out of there? I mean, it has to be heavily processed with high heat. Hexane,
which is it sounds like gasoline for a reason.
Yeah,
because it's in that same that's what it is. Is it's hexane. Extractions are very chemical. I mean, this unfortunately, this is how they make all seed oils.
Yeah. I mean, it's an inedible product, which they have to heavily refine to make edible. Which is the
what are some of your favorite olive oils now that you have that you're selling that you're stoked about? I know it's like saying you pick your favorite kid. But, I mean, I know there's certain from the south of France. There's certain olive oils I've always loved that the nose and the bouquet of. And again, Italy, I could go on and on. I love Moroccan olive oil. I mean, I think that the ones I've had there and the ones I've had here are beautiful. But just give us an idea of some of the things we're going to find on your website.
I'm a big fan of varieties of olives. So from Spain, I love the Ojiblanco. flavor profile. It's just very, very, it's like you get the dried fruit. So it's a very well-balanced oil. You get a little bit of that green fruit, a little bit of the ripe fruit. Most of our producers make that oil. We have a really fantastic producer in the south of Spain called Oro del Desierto, who has just, you know, they're located in this kind of desert oasis, in the desert where they filmed Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So when we went to visit, we actually visited the film set of the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly down the road.
That's one of my favorites.
You know, and then we just kind of crossed over a mountain, and then there was this big, beautiful olive grove, completely not only organic but biodynamic. I mean, they raise animals. They have a little sustainable agro-tourism program there. All of their facilities are... their heat comes from heating the olive pomace.
I've got to go to your website. So it's oliveoillovers.com.
Yeah.
My guest has been Joanne Lacina. We could go on forever, but I'm going to go to your site because I think I'm going to buy that oil. That just sounds great. That sounds ridiculous. Yeah. And you really, I tell you, look, I mean, spend a little extra on olive oil. It's worth it. You don't use much of it when they're great. A little of it goes a long way. It's great for your body. It's an oil that everybody likes, but support the good players. Thanks for coming out to Brooklyn
today.
Thank
you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Again, my guest has been Joanne Lacina. OliveOilLovers.com is her website where you can find descriptions of olive oils, purchase them directly, find out all about the olive varieties, and support the good fight. Thanks. We're not done yet. I've got a couple of guys we're going to talk on about my other favorite discussions, and that's about seafood and sustainability. That's going to take place next. Stay tuned for that. Michael Lameco back with Michael Lameco's Food Talk here in Heritage Radio Network. A couple of great guests coming up. One of my favorite topics, which is seafood and sustainability. Sean Tobias, who's been on this program before last season, who runs Dock to Dish. We'll explain what that is. And Brett Tolley is with him. You guys, welcome. Thanks for coming out today.
Great to be here, Mike.
Thank you very much.
So, Sean, just one more time, in your sound bite best way, Dock to Dish is...
Dock to Dish, Mike, is a community supported fishery program based in Montauk, New York. We have about 150 families are part of our community supported fishery, but we also launched the first restaurant supported fishery program in the U.S., which has got about a dozen chefs from East Hampton to Pocantico Hills participating in the first restaurant supported fishery
and
in the country.
And not to drop names, right. Not bring that swag on, but some guy named Eric Repair that has a restaurant called Le Bernardin. I've heard about that. Yeah. And a guy named Dan Barber who has a place called Blue Hill.
Blue Hill, yeah.
So we're not...
Most people haven't heard of those
spots. Yeah, if you haven't heard of them, go back to sleep.
Yeah.
No, those are huge players. I mean, you've got a hell of a thing going. And the idea, tell me the idea for this. Like, what was the nexus? Because, I mean, fishermen are sort of at the mercy, and women are sort of at the mercy of the markets where they catch their fish. What's the wholesale price at the dock? It's often determined as the boats are unloading and not determined by them. Mm-hmm. And then they sell it to a wholesaler, and there's a couple of middlemen along the way, and then it would end up at a restaurant or in a retail store. You've been able to kind of, I don't want to say value added, but now that these fishermen and women can sell directly, they can kind of cut out the middlemen, also cut out the time and get fresher fish to the market. But talk about when this idea came up and how you put it together.
Okay, so yeah, a whole series of benefits there, Mike. And I think, so the original idea started when I was a kid. I grew up in Shinnecock, like Hampton Bays area. And so, you know, from a very early age, we were fishing and having what we caught for, you know, what we caught that day was for dinner that night. And so that's how I grew up learning what seafood was, like same day source seafood. And so over the years, I started to see this deviation between what was coming through the market and, you know, what we had grown up to know as seafood was two totally different things at the end of the day. So for years and years, a bunch of my buddies were always like, wouldn't it be great if we could somehow figure out a way to get, you know, whatever's landing on the dock that day onto people's plates that night. But the current system is set up, like you mentioned, with this chain of custody where a fisherman sells it to a dockside, a wholesaler who sells it to, you know, it almost all ends up in Fulton Street. And from there, you've got any days to weeks where it could wait. It's kind of a demand market. So a demand, you know, it's all under the umbrella of a demand market place or system there. What we discovered in the community supported fishery is that it puts the horse back before the cart and makes a supply based system. So it's people are surrendering, both our community supported fishery and our chefs in the restaurant supported fishery are saying, okay, we're going to surrender our right to demand from the marketplace and from the ecosystem what we want, what we think we should have or print on our menu, and we're going to accept what the ecosystem and what the dock is providing that day, which sounds simple probably in that couple of sentences there, but is really a revolutionary change.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
So, and the benefits, as you mentioned, that have come out of that as far as like there is no fresher fish. We use a whole series of sustainability programs at NOAA's Fish Watch program, and we're able to really custom cater what we're looking for and what we're taking. And these guys, especially the chefs, are creating, you know, Michael Anthony at Gramercy Tavern, they're creating these dishes where they're using every component of the fish. It's super efficient. They've got like, you know, it's just we're finding that there's the benefits seem to be going and going and going. We're like, wow, this is a...
You're growing, and we can find you guys if you're a social networking type Facebook. You've got a great web page.
DrDish.com, and we're all over Twitter at DrDish.
Yeah, I don't do the Twitter stuff as much, but the Facebook, you can always see pictures of the boats, the docks, people doing little videos. It's great. Brett, tell me what you do and how you got involved in this crazy business.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a community organizer for a small nonprofit called the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance. We're based in Gloucester, Massachusetts. And I'm also from a four-generation commercial fishing family out of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. So our work at NAMA is to work with fishing communities and the fishers who depend on the long-term health of the ocean around fighting for policy and market alternatives. And to connect to DrDish, a lot of our work is also to support community work like DrDish. Community-supported fisheries is one of the first strong organizing tools that we got involved with back in 2008 when the first community-supported fishery program started in Port Clyde, Maine.
So Gloucester, New Bedford, the number one fisheries on the East Coast, huge, up into the Canadian Maritime, huge. I mean, we could talk about all the kinds of fish, but a lot of fish cross your dock. Talk about the families. You mentioned your fourth generation. I want to put a face on this because, you know, like most chefs, I was in New York City. I ordered fish from whoever I ordered fish from, Lou Razzo, whatever it was, and the fish came in a box, iced down. If I liked the way it looked, I took it. If I didn't, I sent it back. But there was no connection of where this was coming from. And then I left New York in 87, opened up a restaurant in Cape May in 88. Big commercial fishing docks down there. I used to go buy my fish directly from the docks, got to know the boats, the captains, the generational aspect of it. I mean, you talk about this, cause I'll shut up, but I mean, how many of these families have been doing this for three, four, five generations? This is all they've done.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right.
I know
right.
He steps into this because it's a great way to make money.
Right.
A couple of
right,
college
right.
frat kids from Westchester say, hey, dude, let's buy a fishing boat, man. Let's do scallops. No.
Yeah. And that's a sort of value that often gets lost in the story of our seafood right now, that there's this culture, there's this community around fisheries that goes so far beyond the actual job of going out to sea and removing fish from the ocean. It's something that, for me personally, that we've taken a lot of pride in, that for generations we've had a sort of stewardship ethic of going out into the ocean and ensuring that we take good care of it, that we're paying attention to the juvenile fish and where they're spawning, that we pay attention to gear type so that we know that this fish will be around for the next generation. I think that's a really core aspect of it too, this ecological aspect of thinking generation to generation, or thinking that it matters to me that the fish are here for my grandchildren and great-grandchildren going forward.
Yeah, there has been a natural tension between the fishermen, the industry, mm-hmm. and the government, NOAA, whoever it is that's doing the oversight. In some cases, it's worked out beautifully. I think scallops was a great example of that in the 90s, where they did some research, found out they were harvesting small scallops that weren't of breeding age yet, and by raising the ring sides that they dropped, they were picking up bigger scallops that had a chance to convert beds. They shut beds down, examined them, reopened them, and now we're at 51, 52 million pounds a year off the North Atlantic. Give us a couple of other examples of some fisheries that have done well. Because I know, like cod, the biomass is down. I mean, we're managing the cod that's left, mm-hmm. which is somewhere between 10 and 20% of what it was originally. 80% of the cod stocks are down from their highs, but...
I'm probably fresh on those stats, Brett. I think we have... So to back that up a little bit, Magnuson-Stevens and this sweeping legislation in 1976 that came and really changed the laws in this country. And currently, the United States is a beacon of light around the globe for well-managed, sustainable fisheries. And so...
The best. Out 200 miles.
Correct. Yeah. And so we've got currently, in the Mid-Atlantic, 24 different species that have been rebuilt to a sustainable level. So if you go to NOAA's Fish Watch program, it's fishwatch.gov, mm-hmm. you'll be able to see the 2013 assessment levels. And essentially, the target there being, NOAA tries to build our fish populations up to maximum sustainable yield. So it would be the same, Mike, as if you had a bank account that you kept the principal the same and only took off the interest. And so that's the same scenario. So right now you've got sea bream, scup, porgy, Brett and I were just talking about, but black sea bass, bluefish, 24 different species of fish that NOAA has under management plans that are at a sustainable, not overfished level. So we're now seeing, I think, the laws of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, very strict, made it nearly impossible for fishermen to survive. And you saw an eradication of a profession to a large degree in this country, and very much like the vanishing of a piece of history in the United States with American fishermen. But now what we're left with is we're reaping the rewards of that legislation. And now 30 years later, you've got, you're seeing the 24 different fish population stocks that have rebuilt to a level that the United States government says, you can continue harvesting just the interest, quote unquote, and these fish populations, barring some big variables there, ocean acidification, climate change, estuary degradation, you've got some other big variables. As far as fishing is concerned, it is the tightest management, the best run fisheries in the world that we have right now. So,
And we're not going to talk about the Alaskan fisheries, but that's a great story what's going on up there in the Bering Seas. Let's talk about some of the species you just threw out, because I think one of the things consumers, all of us to some extent, are guilty of is Americans like to eat the same species of fish. Mm-hmm. We like salmon. We like tuna. We like swordfish steaks. We like shrimp. Those are the big four, and they constitute a shit ton of what gets eaten in this country. Now, if you bore down a little bit, you'll find out that unless you're eating Alaskan salmon, everything else you're eating is farm-raised salmon.
Right.
Without exception. Tuna, it's a species with a lot of pressure on it. There's mercury issues with tuna. It's an apex feeder. Ditto swordfish. Swordfish stocks have certainly been depleted. It's an apex feeder. I'm not sure how much of mercury you want to put in your system by eating that. And shrimp, which is, unless you're getting Florida, I'm lucky Cape May gets Florida super sane, fresh shrimp every week, Friday morning, lands on my market. So I'm supporting local fishery, but I don't even want to talk about where most of that stuff's coming from. So let's not talk about those fish.
Good.
Let's talk about porgy. Let's talk about porgy scup, same thing. Black sea bass, which to me is one of the greatest delicacies out of our waters. Maybe fish like totog, whiting, some of the fish that you and I love as fish consumers, mm-hmm. but consumers have need to be educated about.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's a huge component of what we do, Mike, is re-educating our members and making available underutilized species. So we've got these huge booming populations of, like, you know, the greatest recent example is Atlantic Gurnard or sea robin, which if you look right now, the cover of Edible East End magazine is an Atlantic Gurnard, which people are like, what? It's a sea robin. It's the most curious looking. It's wings. It walks. Smile. Yeah. Yeah. It talks. It makes a grunting noise when you catch it, but it
and this
is
tail meat is so delicious. Freaking delicious.
Totally. So guys like Michael Anthony and Jason Weiner and Amon, a lot of our chefs, we started running that at the beginning of the summer to them because it's everywhere. We're catching them in pound traps. The rod and reel guys are catching them, and it's literally everywhere. But our community sported fishery members don't have recipes for it. They don't know how it's supposed to look, how it's supposed to cook. It's an intimidating looking fish. And so what we found is this dynamic between our chef members in the restaurant sported fishery division of Dr. Dish and the community sported fishery. Dan Barber, for example, gave a quote to Florence Fabricant about, you know, sea robin and an Atlantic Gurnard bouillabaisse and these kind of interesting, a few of the chefs were working with these different recipes. And suddenly we had this great kind of enthusiasm erupt in our community sport fishery where people really, that's where we're finding they're very much willing to try these new underutilized species that they've never seen before. But because the chefs are cooking with them, like, you can probably make you know, a delicious dish out of anything that comes out of the sea.
So when I first moved to Cape May, like, the sport fishing guys can be little wankers too. You know, like, I'm eating squid, they're like, that, I don't eat that, that's bait. You know, I'm like, dude, and they're throwing stuff back. I mean, skate wings, like, catch skate. It's a bycatch if you're doing stripers. You put a clam on the bottom, you get it. You can only tell me you really need it. Well, I got it, and then you know, that's not a striper, it's dead weight. Things are hard to get the hook. I'm like, I'll take your skate. Give it to me. I'll put it in my bag. I'll give it a day or two to flap. I mean, I love skate wings. To me, it's a delicacy. Blowfish tails. Mm-hmm. I mean, please. Those things are, like, insane. Anything that's fresh that's out of the water is delicious.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. And so we find that the freshness factor trumps the historical demand for species or for, you know, different sizes of things that the chefs would. Now that it's freshness is king. And, like, knowing your fishermen, having access to your local fishery is where you're going to get the freshest.
Union fish. Square yesterday, they must have been reading your mind. That whoever, I know who they are, I forget the family's name, but there's a Union Square market. They're in the middle of that one side, and they're there on Wednesdays. And they had sea robin, whole sea robin. They're selling them whole, not filleted out. And I'm like, I'm not going to make bouillabaisse at home. I got some scallops. I got some squid from them. But I love to buy fish there every Wednesday. You know, another fish I think that gets really pounded down and misrepresented is bluefish.
Agreed.
They're in our waters. They're great. I particularly like the ones that are about yay big, like a foot to a foot and a half or a little smaller. Cocktails or snappers, we call them down in South Jersey. What a great delicacy, man. This is just a wonderful fish.
Yeah. So great one. I mean, that's a really glowing example, Mike, of bluefish is a specific type of fish that's got a histidine in it, and it's got an enzyme that starts, once it's killed, it starts to break down. So you probably put one in your freezer or your fridge, and a few days later, it kind of turns to that pudding mess.
Yeah, I don't know. I buy it and I eat it that night. I buy it whole, and I fillet it out and eat it that night.
Extremely fresh. And so we found that that was probably our most popular fish this summer, was that it doesn't, it has no shelf life. It can't survive the traditional chain of custody and the market route where it sits and waits and sits and waits. And
what's that compound called?
It's called, it's a histidine.
Histidine, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
I think if you Google histidine.
As opposed to histamines.
Histamines,
which is,
right. And so we have HACCP plans and all these careful things to control how much histidine levels rise in bluefish. And so that's what really alerted us. And from kids, we knew if you have same day, and like you said, the size of a small or medium cocktail blue that's bled on the spot, that's iced immediately. Yeah. And those fillets within 24 or 48 hours, there's no, that's a fisherman's favorite fish. In Montauk, I'd say a lot
they're
of the guys,
they're kind of grayish, you know, blue almost. Kind of, and then when you cook them, they turn white.
White.
It's beautiful.
Exactly.
Like the color changes in the pan.
Yep.
And a little lemon, a little bit of capers. They're great blackened. I mean, it's just such a great fish.
Yeah.
And full of fish oils, full of omega-3s.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Omega-3s everywhere.
Some fish that you'd like to see people eating.
Yeah, well, all the ones mentioned, bluefish, the underappreciated, underloved species is what we like to call them. From the fisherman's perspective, that they're out there, and these are seasonal. It's what they're pulling up in their nets or catching on their hooks. And for most, they would love to be able to make a living or get a fair price from these species. But with the disconnect of the market and, you know, focusing only on those four species you mentioned earlier, oftentimes fishers are not getting paid a fair price, and so they'll focus on something else, and often that leads to an intense pressure on those more traditional species. So the community-supported fisheries and work like Dock to Dish is creating these really important new avenues for people to connect to what is in season, what is local. And I just go back to one species that we said we didn't want to talk about, which is shrimp. And shrimp's an interesting one in particular because in the States, out of all the shrimp consumed, 99.5% is imported, industrial scale, and it has an incredible track record of labor violations and slavery issues as well. But there actually is a shrimp fishery here on the East Coast, and actually relates back to the first community-supported fishery program that started in Port Clyde, Maine. There is a seasonal local shrimp fishery there, and the fishermen who depended on that fishery were getting paid, at the time, 30 cents a pound. And the reason why was because the cheap imported industrial shrimp were undercutting their local price. And the fishermen got together and they said, look, if we continue fishing, trying to compete with this 30 cent a pound shrimp, we are going in one direction, and that's towards overfishing this shrimp. We have to do it another way. And that was the sort of impetus of creating this community-supported fishery. They realized they needed to connect more directly to their community. There needed to be a level of education and people realizing that if fishermen want to be stewards and actually take care of this resource, fair price has to be included.
Are those great little red shrimp?
Yeah, they're sweet.
They're sweet. They're
smaller.
Tiny. They're amazing. They're really tiny, but they're like red candy, man.
Yeah,
they're so good. I love those shrimp.
That's right.
And I think part of what you're saying too. I think part of it is part of the education for me. The takeaway is that to educate the public, you've got to get the chefs involved.
Indeed,
because if the chefs are doing it, and then Food and My writes about it, or Florence Fabricant writes about it, or Bon Appetit picks it up as a story, then suddenly Americans are going, "Oh, tilefish,
golden tilefish.
Oh,
right.
That's a fish that's making a big comeback. It's sustainable. You've seen them on Long Island. We've seen them off Jersey. Mm-hmm. You know, you can buy those retail for whatever under $10 a pound or somewhere. Incredibly good fish. I mean, but it's got to come from you through the chefs." Then the press to the people.
Exactly right. Exactly right, Mike. That's the we find that the chefs are the power brokers in this whole kind of deal that we're trying to reintroduce underutilized species. I can yell from the rooftops like everybody should try Atlantic Gurnard, and people are like, get out of here. But if you or, you know, Michael Anthony, Dan Barber, these guys are like, dudes, here's how you make it. Try it. It's off the charts delicious. Right. Suddenly we get this big warm embrace of like, okay, let's give it a shot. And that's the solution right there.
And one other thing just to add to that is, part of our education, we always use the phrase, know your fisherman. We know on the farm side, we have know your food, know your farmer. We're trying to say, know your food, know your fisher. Yeah. And there's this aspect of embracing what's local and what's seasonal. And in the fisheries, that can, you know, be within a year's span. Sometimes a fish may be migrating in our area for 5 years or 10 years at a time and can actually move on. And so in terms of focusing on the single species element, we're really trying to get away from that in a way and talk more about what's seasonal, what's local. Know your fishermen and know what they're pulling up in their nets or catching on their hooks, and trying to think differently, because we know this single species focus on cod and tuna and swordfish has really put fishermen in a position where they're being told these are the only fish that the market cares about. And so to get away from that, I think we want to encourage, you know, chefs and the public to think differently and think seasonally.
Is there a website that you would suggest people go to get more information? I mean, I love the NOAA one, and that was
NOAA's Fish Watch program.
Fishwatch. So NOAA's NOAA. So you just go to National Oceanographic, blah, blah, blah. Fish Watch. What's the one on the West Coast? The Bay, or what's it called?
The Monterey Bay.
Monterey Bay.
Watch.
It's not bad.
Yeah, it's a good start.
So where would you suggest, though? Where should people go?
Yeah, well, folks can visit our website at NAMA to go a little bit deeper on these issues. It's namanet.org, N-A-M-A-N-E-T.org. Another really great website is localcatch.org. and it's sort of a hub for all of the community-supported fisheries around the country and allows people to have more direct access to know who is catching your local seafood.
Great, guys. We never have enough time. I'm not going to do this. Next time I have you on, it's going to be like the whole hour or most of the hour.
Yeah, well, thanks Sounds for having
good.
Us,
no,
Mike. It's great
to be
back.
20 minutes. We can't even skip a stone on the top of this one. Sean Tobias, Dr. Dish. You could find out a friend of him on Facebook. Just Google Dr. Dish, see what they do. Brett Jolly, his website, N like Nancy, A, M like Michael, A, NET.org or localcatch.org. Find out what they're talking about, what we're talking about, and what we'd like you to learn more about. Thanks so much, folks. This day's food talk is over. We'll be back next week with another show with hopefully not too many guests. Thanks for listening. And again, thanks, Sean and Brett, for coming out, man.
Thank you, Mike. Great to be here.
Whoa! Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.